I'm John Moskow.
And I'm Amy Halperin-Laff. Welcome to Ethical Schools. Today, we'll continue our conversation with Harry Fader, Executive Director of FairTest, a national nonprofit that advocates for equitable and transparent educational testing. Harry came to FairTest after a long career in public education in New York City as a teacher, researcher, and advocate. Last time, we spoke about college admissions tests, particularly the SAT. Today, we'll focus on high-stakes tests in K through 12. Welcome back, Harry.
Thanks. Great to be here.
How did testing and test preparation become such a huge part of the K through 12 experience?
Well, I mean, testing was always there. We all took some kind of tests in grade school and high school. There were even some standardized tests. I remember taking something called like the Iowa test or something like that in the fifth grade or in the third grade, just to see how we did versus everybody else. But the real current emphasis on testing and high stakes testing, I would say, begins in the Reagan era, or with the Reagan era, with the 1983 report, A Nation at Risk, where there was, and this is a consistent trope. Our systems are failing. Our kids don't know anything. I mean, if you like do media searches going back decades, you'll see this over and over and over again. But this time, and this is supported by Bill Bennett, who is Reagan's education secretary, that we have to do something to make sure that students are achieving. And it took the next sort of 20 years. There was something in the Clinton administration also, but this coalesced nationally. At the state level in the 90s, there are some states that are adding high stakes tests, like Massachusetts started this MCAS test, which is actually now maybe decoupled, at least from high stakes consequences. That's a later conversation. And so the law that was passed was No Child Left Behind in 2000. And this is maybe the last piece of truly bipartisan legislation passed by the Congress, because it was the brainchild, or it was the coming together of the pre-9/11 administration of George W. Bush and Senator Kennedy. So they basically, and from the left's perspective, from the Senator Kennedy perspective, the reason to have lots of standardized tests is to shine a light on inequity in school, to basically show that what we basically knew, that students in poor districts, students of racial minorities, underrepresented minorities, perform worse on these tests. And the idea would be that if you make school systems raise test scores, that will cause resources to be funneled into the places where they're needed most. Now, so it created the system that each kid had to be tested in math and English every year from grades 3 through 8, and once in high school, and also tested in science in high school, and that schools, teachers, and students will be judged on these test scores, and that districts need to show schools and districts need to show something called adequate yearly progress. But No Child Left Behind said, you know, and in 10 years, everybody will be perfect, right? Which was ludicrous, of course. And the problem with this was that that states basically had to ramp up their testing programs and ramped up their testing programs. Tests started to take up a lot of time. Test preparation started to take up a lot of time. And there began to be a bubbling up of lots of complaints from teachers, from parents, particularly interestingly in sort of suburban school districts. Long Island in New York is a good example of this, where parents start complaining, like, hey, what happened to school? All our kids are doing, they're getting ready for these tests. They spend weeks and weeks taking these batteries of tests, And then the schools are rated and ranked based on test scores. There were provisions then for the state to come in and, you know, a school, if they didn't make adequate yearly progress over time, could be a school in need of improvement, or CINI. And thus the state would sort of swoop in and have some sort of improvement plan. And this was all based on test scores. The other thing, interesting thing that this did is because now suddenly you have this trove of data about test scores of schools and districts, in swoops the real estate industry and now starts grading, you know, websites like Zillow and Trulia, and they basically take test scores, rank school districts, and say, here's now, you know, of course, as we know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the districts that are wealthy, that funnel a lot of property tax money into their school systems, have higher test scores, whether they do test prep or not. It's a socioeconomic thing. And so that maintains the, if you will, quality and segregation of suburban neighborhoods. This is sort of less of a problem in an urban district where sort of all the money gets mixed together. Now, this backlash eventually created a call for reform. And so in 2016, the end of the Obama administration, the current law is called ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act. That took away the high stakes consequences. The whole adequate yearly progress system got thrown out. But the mandates for each kid to be tested twice in grades 3 through 8, and then again in high school, remains. And, you know, states didn't just suddenly abandon their testing system. So standardized testing is still, as a result of, now there's a lot, and we can talk about this, there's sort of a lot of efforts at reform, some of it good, some of it bad. There's backlash to high stakes consequences for tests. There was a time when 27 states had a graduation test, and now we're down to 9, and we may soon be down to 7, which we can talk about. You know, as with all things social policy, there's like a pendulum swing, but this is where the testing regime comes from.
So, Harry, how much autonomy do states and districts have in terms of, you know, how and when kids are tested?
Oh, that's a good question. They had less autonomy under NCLB. They have more autonomy now, but not really. So states and districts are required to test kids again twice, once in each grade level, and every kid. So you can't do things like what the NAEP does. The NAEP is the National
Assessment of Education Progress.
That is a test that's sort of given nationally randomly. So not every kid takes it. And that's basically, and you know, you don't know when it's coming either. So you can make the argument it's sort of a truer measure of what's really going on. And it basically, that's designed to sort of show trends. And I will say, like, sitting from the FAIR test perspective, I don't have that much of a problem with NAEP, because that is kind of the heat check, as you will. That's the thermostat. And if it shows that, like, we really, you know, after COVID, the NAEP scores went down, you know, I mean, of course, people engage in what we call misnapery, which is like they use the NAEP scores for they come to the wrong conclusion. Like, we need X. It's like, no, we don't need more testing. What we need is, like, to get kids back in school. Yeah. Obviously, Zoom school, no good. So the states have some flexibility in what they use as their math and English test. Like, they can develop their own product, as some states do. You know, California has the California test, or at one point there were these consortia that were created that were linked to the Common Core. They're PARC and Smarter Balanced. Those tests still exist. So some states are still using a Smarter Balanced test for their ESSA accountability test. At the high school level, about half the states use the SAT or the ACT as their accountability test. So kids have to take those tests. You know, I think the current problem with testing time is, interestingly, not just those summative tests at the end of the year, but now there are all sorts of what we call interim assessments or formative assessments. There's a program, you talk about flexibility. There are 13 states now that have gotten dispensation from the federal government to do something called through-year testing, which is instead of one at the end, you get like four during the course of the year. The argument is, well, you get more information more quickly that the teacher can use. The truth of the matter is, if you're using a commercial product produced by the NWEA, there's a RAND study, surveys of teacher data show that some people like those things. Most people, most teachers and schools don't. Well, I mean, administrators do, but a lot of teachers and parents and kids don't because they can't really use them and they're divorced from what actually goes on in the classroom. They're not like teacher created assessments or even kind of they're not even district created assessments. They're off the shelf assessments. It's different when a district. So the issue is, so states and localities do have lots of flexibility other than this mandate of once for every kid, math, English, 3 through 8.
So as you've mentioned, things have changed from No Child Left Behind to ESSA. But in general, what would you say the consequences for students, teachers, and schools are for both low test scores? And on the other hand, what are the benefits for high test scores at grade levels?
Before I answer that question, I just want to go back to Amy's question because I want to add one thing to that. In ESSA, there are two provisions that are supposed to allow for assessment innovation. There's something called IADA, the Innovative Assessment Demonstration Authority, that a state can kind of buy into and say, you know, we want to try something different than your standard off-the-shelf assessment. The problem is there's a requirement in that provision that the replacement has to be comparable. So when like New Hampshire tried to do a statewide system of performance assessment in the beginning, and that kind of fell apart because of the comparability, it's kind of, they weren't allowed to do enough kind of teacher-driven innovative stuff that makes performance assessment really work. And then there was also a political change in New Hampshire, which kind of killed the whole thing. But there are other and so very few states now participate in that. Three, I think. And because the thing is it's too complicated. It's too much red tape. We can't really innovate. But there's also something called, this a smaller program called CGSA, which is the competitive grants for state assessments. And so, for example, New York, but those are small. They're like $1 million to $3 million, which for like a state like New York isn't a lot of money. But like New York has used its to do this something called a plan pilot, which is to find schools that are interested in doing performance-based assessments, career and technical education, and to have those assessments be developed in lieu of the more standardized tests. So there's some additional innovation that is incentivized, but it's not enough, and the rules are kind of make it so it's hard to do. Now, John, your question, which is the consequences. So obviously, you know, there's the first consequence for sort of a district and a school is, well, both reward and stigma, if you will. So if the test scores are low, then it's a school with low test scores. Why is it? Does that mean make it a bad school? Not necessarily, right? Because you have to look at the socioeconomic background of the kids. You have to look at where they are in sort of their process of curriculum. There's a lot of things but once you are labeled with, and this goes what I was talking to before, you know, it's like how the real estate sites use the test scores. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you know, there are lots of evidence that when standardized tests become too important, you wind up quote unquote teaching to the test, and that crowds out the subjects that aren't subject to standardized tests, like social studies, history, art, music, all those things. And this was another complaint in the No Child Left Behind days, is that in particular in schools of more limited means, you know, there goes the art teacher. Why? Because we need another reading specialist. Now, you know, kids need to know how to read. I'm not sort of suggesting that that's not important. It's very important. It's crucial. But there was a definitely a sense that the things that weren't tested in that way weren't counted and thus didn't get any attention. And that's just sort of bad for education generally. So that's one real, and you know, the stig, how you perform on standardized tests is not indicative of your overall capacity and intelligence. So we have become a system where success on these tests have become the coin of the realm to being deemed smart or dumb. And that has very deep consequences to the psyche of a student. It also has creates a lot of pressure on teachers and schools, you know, to if not to de-emphasize the tests, then to, you know, get kids to do well. Not surprisingly, we got like cheating scandals and things like that, like the one in Atlanta in the beginning, because of the pressure. What is it? Campbell's Law, right? If you attach lots of consequences to something, you are essentially going to incentivize gaming systems, right? And just like recently, you know, there were AP tests floating around for sale. Why? Because AP test scores have become really important for the college admissions process. So as soon as you attach those kind of consequences, you're basically saying we're not doing education for the sake of education. We're doing education for the sake of ranking and sorting you. And that's, I mean, it's consistent with the ethos of post-Reagan and post-Reagan America. And this is kind of where we see it with young people.
Okay. How does this impact teaching as a profession, both the teacher satisfaction and retention?
Yeah, low satisfaction and low rates of retention. I mean, I think that standardized tests done in this way deprofessionalize teaching, right? When you, because the next thing is you get scripted curricula, you're basically telling a teacher you can't, that teaching is no longer a craft or a profession, but rather you are somebody working on the assembly line and your job on this assembly line. You know, it's a very, at its sort of most dystopian place, it becomes a Tayloristic view of education, right? Because if you ever walk into, as I had the pleasure, those are air quotes around pleasure. I forgot there's no video here. Of like spending some time in a no excuses charter school. I won't name the brand. And literally the class time is scripted by the minute, right? And that is straight out of like Henry Ford, Frederick Winslow Taylor efficiency models for the industrial economy, right? Why? Because the end product is we have to get those test scores up. And thus the way to do it is to kind of regulate students in this way that is very controlled. It also, I will say, you know, it's interesting because Lenin was a big fan of Frederick Winslow Taylor because it was a way to industrialize, you know, it is man as machine as sort of part of this sort of collective whole. And, you know, so we have to sort of make sure that you play your part. And that's the part of teachers. There is very little discretion. There's also very little trust, right? Part of the problem with testing being so central to the education story is we do it in part because we don't trust teachers to do their job, right? Now, not to say that like all professions are regulated. Lawyers are regulated, doctors are regulated, you have to get certifications, you know, all that stuff, right? But it's different because there are some elements to like ranking hospitals and, you know, all that stuff, but how many, or your blood pressure is a real number that's indicated of physical forces. A test score does not give you a magic window into everything that a kid is doing. It's different. It's palpably different.
I wanted to go back just for a second to the consequences question. And mm-hmm. I don't know if this is specific to New York or perhaps to some of the other big cities or not, but if you could talk a little bit about the ways that test scores are used for things like middle school and high school admissions.
Right. Well, that's an admissions question. That's, again, different. So when test scores become sort of the coin of the realm for middle school admissions or high school admissions, you wind up getting segregation. And that's been true in New York City. It's true in Chicago. And it's not just like residential segregation breeds education segregation. As soon as you create a gifted and talented school, lo and behold, that school becomes wealthier, whiter, all of those things. So that's one thing, you know, and there is another argument. Do we really want to separate people in that way? Can't you have like an integrated school, both integrated in ability and just like have different differentiation for different kinds of students? You know, I confess I am a product of a standardized test in some ways, because I went to the Bronx High School of Science, which you can only get in by through scoring X on a test. Now, this was a long time ago, and the way we view these things is different than the way we view it now. There has become I barely prepared for that test, number one. And so now there's an entire testing industry that it floats around, and, you know, Kumon or whatever else it is, where kids basically engage in test prep to get into these schools, both middle school and high school. The other thing is, you know, I recognize that while I was lucky, there were a lot of people who would have done great at Bronx Science, but they didn't have the test score, but they might show their intelligence in lots of other ways other than a time test. There are people who test well and there are people who don't test as well. And that's just human intelligence. I fail to believe, and I guess that's why I do what I do, should not be reduced to a single instrument, right? So as soon as you add other things, now it may be that, you know, if you're going to Bronx Science, you need to have some minimal proficiency in the ability to do some mathematics. Okay, fine, but you have to look at other things as well. So I think that using it as a sole instrument in particular, or a major instrument, has wound up creating both segregation and a lack of opportunity for lots of people who would benefit from the opportunity. We view seats in middle school and high school, which is certainly, you know, products of socioeconomics, like how you're doing in the fourth grade, right? Or personal chemistry, even, I don't know. You know, we view that as being already this scarce resource, right? Which is preposterous. I mean, we talked about that in our college admissions discussion, but it's even worse at this stage because like everybody needs, you know, an adequate education in algebra or whatever, even if you're never going to learn calculus.
You've written and spoken about the relationship between commercial testing companies and textbook companies. Would you explain that?
Sure. There are sort of synergistic things that go on with tests and then materials for the test, right? So if Pearson says, okay, you know, and this, like, just to use the Common Core as an example, if Smarter Balanced has this contract with Pearson, right, then, okay, here are the tests. And now, oh, you know, if kids want to do well with the test, here is the book that goes with the test. I mean, it's obvious, I think, because assessment drives instruction, assessment drives curriculum. What you test, you have to teach, or try to teach. And thus it gives the opportunity to create lots of, and now, you know, we have computer technology, obviously, there are tests, there are standardized tests that are what I'd call iterative, that depending on whether you get a question right or not, you basically get one question versus a different question. So it sort of calibrates levels of difficulty. And so those companies, Cambridge Associates, Pearson, NWEA, you know, they're making a lot of money off this stuff. And what they'll say is, okay, you know, in order to get kids to do well, we also have this packet of materials, how to teach fractions, right? So here, use this too. And, you know, systems, districts buy lots of curriculum and textbook writ large. I mean, the word textbook doesn't necessarily mean that big fat book anymore, right? There's a lot of kind of materials, if you will, but they're commercially produced and generated. And, you know, you can say, well, the teacher can do what it wants with that stuff. Going back to your, you know, deprofessionalizing, it's like you're basically telling the trial lawyer, here's the script for the trial, right? We've tested it out. This works. But there's a jury there of humans. And the good trial lawyer knows that, like, I maybe need to leave some things out for this jury. So yes, the teacher still has the capacity to monkey around with the materials. But as soon as you say there's a test at the end and our results are going to matter because the principal has a meeting with the superintendent and then the superintendent has a meeting with their supervisor and then we have to show our test scores to the board and that all the people in the district who own homes want their property values to be maintained and thus they need to see high test scores, you see where the incentive structure goes. Mm-hmm. And it's not to, like, what do you feel like learning today, Johnny? That's not part of the equation. Mm-hmm. You know, Johnny may not be in the mood for fractions on Monday. Johnny may be in the mood for like a science experiment. I don't know. I'm not saying that there isn't stuff you have to teach and all that, but the craft, the profession, I'll use the word profession, right, of teaching gets undermined when the bottom line is, what is the purpose of a corporation? Is to make money for its shareholders, nothing else. We can talk about the ethical obligations of a corporation, but under the law, if the corporation is not making money for its shareholders, it's violating its fiduciary duty and it can be sued under securities law, right? It's true. It's called shareholder derivative actions. I used to defend them sometimes. And, you know, that's kind of what we created here. We said, like, you don't get the test scores up, you failing, right? But a school is not producing pints of Ben and Jerry's ice cream. It's different. First of all, you don't get to pick your ingredients, right? They're given to you and you have to, it's about sort of human development, which is a much more complex process than is both captured and incentivized by standardized tests.
Right. You have a fascinating paper on the Fair Test website about PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment. The line that really stood out to me is, America's problem on PISA is poverty and inequality, not curriculum and instruction. Would you explain what it is that PISA tests and why US scores haven't been higher?
Well, first of all, if you factored out poverty, US does pretty damn well versus, I think the paper makes that point. If you compare our, whatever it is, top 10% of socioeconomics with the equivalent socioeconomic strata in Sweden, which is more like 80% of the population, right? We do just fine. We're like in the top five of everything, or something like that. I will say this about PISA. PISA itself, if you listen to Andreas Schlichter lately, who's the OECD dude who oversees PISA, they're moving in a direction to try to measure things that aren't sort of classically standardized test stuff. They're trying to measure things like creativity and deeper thinking and problem solving. It's hard to do in a standardized setting is the problem, but they have like a new part of the piece that the US actually didn't participate in because our school systems are so diffuse, it would like be impossible to say the US does X, right? We're just like too big and diverse. We're not, you know, even like a place like France, there's, if you walk in to an Ecole in Lyon and an Ecole in Paris on the same week, you'll probably hear a similar lesson because there's kind of mandated curricula, but their legal system is different too. So. But PISA generally measures sort of math, English, and I think science. And I think there's like a social studies thing too. And it, you know, it's a standardized test. And the two shining stars in the PISA test have been like, you know, Singapore, where everything is small and controlled. And interestingly, Finland, where the teaching profession is held in tremendously high regard. To be a teacher is like to be a university professor, to be a doctor, to be a lawyer, right? And they actually like don't start kids in school till like they're seven. And they, you know, there's all sorts of, but Finland, interestingly, their scores have been going down. Why? They've been going down since everybody got an iPhone. So, and my friend Sam Abrams has like written about this. So
we've interviewed Sam.
Oh, good. Yes. He taught it. We taught together at same school. And he's wonderful. And I'll just put a plug. He's just sort of moved to start like a new institute in connection with NEPC at University of Colorado Boulder, like a looking International Institute of Privatization. He's leaving Teachers College to do that. So you might want to talk to him again soon. So that's the argument that it's really that our scores that are low are because of poverty and inequality, because the poor kids don't do as well on these tests. And we've got a lot of poor kids.
Yeah. So what does Fair Test propose as an alternative to the current testing system in K-12?
Yeah. So a couple of things. You know, we're big proponents of what I would call broadly performance-based assessments, ways that kids can demonstrate their learning through problem solving, designing experiments. Sometimes it's called project-based learning. Now, that's not to say they don't like take tests and quizzes and learn facts or things like that. It's just how do they demonstrate their knowledge in a larger way? And there are ways where you can kind of standardize the skills and the levels that you are assessing through well-designed rubrics. It's more difficult than a fill-in-the-bubble test to do that. And teachers and schools can take the overall standards and rubrics and design things that fit the needs of their and levels of their kids and allow them to sort of succeed and demonstrate what they know. And there are lots of places that do this. You know, New York has a group of schools called the New York Performance Standards Consortium that have very, you can go to their website, they have very well-established rubrics in all the major disciplines. Kids have to present, you know, another thing that it assesses is oral skills, which don't get assessed on any of these standardized tests, which last time I checked was a big part of life. So there's that element to it. Massachusetts has a group of districts called MCIEA, the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Educational Assessments. They're developing sort of common tasks. They have like this task bank. Oh, you want to do fifth grade science? Like, here's something that was developed in Lowell, Massachusetts on, you know, how to test the porousness of rock. You know, you could do that. And there are districts. Anaheim, California is a district that has committed itself to performance-based assessment. New Mexico, Colorado, they're places that have graduation capstones where you sort of assess kids on like their final projects. So that I think should be the major part of educational assessment. I think the other thing I would keep is NAEP, right? So we can sort of make sure that districts are and schools are actually capturing skills, et cetera, et cetera. You know, in the earlier grades, you still want teachers to use standardized tests to, let's say, determine whether a kid is dyslexic or, you know, in a diagnostic way. Mm-hmm. I think standardized tests absolutely have a role there, you know, done selectively and judiciously. Under no circumstances should there be high stakes consequences attached to any of this. And I think that's the bottom line. That's when we misuse standardized tests as opposed to using them as diagnostic, evaluative, and thermostat-like tools. I think we also have to change ESSA. And there's a bill out there that hasn't gone anywhere, the More Teaching, Less Testing Act, which would basically change the formula to allow states to do matrix sampling, not test every kid every year. So just reduce the number of testing, but still get the information that you need to sort of see how different subgroups are doing and to sort of maintain the sunlight on the inequalities.
Thank you, Harry Fader of Fair Test.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure to be here.
And thank you, listeners. Check out our new video series, What Would You Do? A collaboration with Professor Mira Levinson of the Harvard Graduate School of Education and Ed Ethics. Go to our website, ethicalschools.org, and click video. The goal of the series is not to provide right answers, but to illustrate a variety of ethical viewpoints. If you found this podcast worthwhile, please share it with a friend or colleague. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating or a review. This helps others to find the show. Check out our website for more episodes and articles and to subscribe to our monthly emails. We post annotated transcripts of our interviews to make them easy to use in workshops or classes. Contact us at hosts@ethicalschools.org. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Our editor and social media manager is Amanda Denchi. Until next week. Thank you.